This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Lucy May. As hard as they've tried, scientists haven't found any evidence of extraterrestrial life. But author Jamie Green writes the idea we might be alone in the galaxy is relatively new. In her book, The Possibility of Life, she charts the course of humanity's search for fellowship in the universe and what it tells us about ourselves and what it means to be human. She joins me now along with astronomer and host of the Looking Up podcast, Dean Regas. Thanks for being here, Jamie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back, Dean.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Always great to have you in the studio. Jamie, how did we first come to the question the possibility of other worlds with intelligent life outside our own? At what point in history did this happen?
I mean, in some ways, I think this question is older than recorded history. Humans have always wondered about what else there might be beyond the world we see. And so even if we go into religion and mythology, that's about imagining other kinds of people, you know, the gods, the angels, ghosts, whatever it is. You know, we've always been looking for something more than what's on Earth. But in the legacy of Western science, there was a big turning point around the Renaissance where a couple of scientific advances actually made it possible to imagine life on other worlds, because for the first time, we had reason to believe that there were other worlds. Before Copernicus and Galileo, for millennia, the dominant worldview was that the sun was at the center of the that the Earth was in the center of the universe and that everything, including the sun, orbited around us. And it wasn't until Copernicus did the math and realized that the sun was at the center and the Earth was orbiting just like everything else, and Galileo developed new telescopes that were able to see the planets, which to the naked eye just looked like a point of light in the sky, and he realized that they were worlds just like Earth. And so all of a sudden we knew that we were just one world among others, and suddenly there was all this imaginative possibility in science and in science fiction, which were very blurry and indistinct at that point, to start imagining and actually believing that there was life on other worlds.
And at that point, it sounds like it wasn't a question of if there was life on other worlds. It was more a question of what was out there and when we would find it. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The thinking was basically, it was this radical discovery that the planets were worlds just like Earth is, were made of the same materials. You could start seeing mountains and shapes in the landscape on the moon. And so the thinking was just, okay, if they're made of the same things that the Earth is made of, they would have life just like Earth. Because also at that time, life was thought to be some sort of tangible vital force. You know, the question of what takes matter and turns it into something living was, I mean, it's still pretty unanswered, but even then, so it was just taken for granted. And so the early stories, many of which were written by astronomers, imagine other kinds of people on other worlds. But then these became ways of playing out the implications of new discoveries. So one example is, it was thought for a while that the moon had higher mountains than the Earth does. And so then the life that was imagined on the moon was still people and plants and animals, but they were bigger, you know, bigger terrain, bigger life. And then when Darwin comes along and the idea of evolution is added into it, that starts being applied to life on other worlds. So if the theory at the time was that the planets on the outside of the solar system formed first and then inward and inward, then the logic goes that the life on the farther out planets would be more advanced than the life farther in. And that's where we get turn of the century stories like War of the Worlds of more advanced Martians coming to terrorize us on Earth, because Mars was thought to be older than Earth, and so they had more time to evolve.
Dean, tell us more about this theory of these frighteningly superior Martian invaders.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that if they have the technology to cross over to the Earth and visit the Earth, then logic suggests then they're going to be more advanced than us. And all the observations of Mars at the turn of the century, turn of the 19th to 20th century, were mysterious. And it's one of those things that I've had this unique perspective. I've been able to look through turn of the century telescopes at Mars specifically. So at the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, they looked at Mars and saw canals, these straight line formations. And so the astronomers that were looking at this, oh, hey, I see canals too. And then everybody's seeing canals and everybody's seeing features. And they say, well, okay, why are they building canals? And then you speculate, well, they're drying out. They're running out of water and they need to bring water from the poles. And then they look, then the Martians are going to look through their telescopes and see our beautiful blue Earth from there with all of our water and then come and take our water. Now, that was a long stretch, wasn't it? To go from I see lines on a planet to a whole scenario of what the Martians might be like and what they might be into. But this was a thing where these observations kind of fueled this idea of this. And we still have it today a little bit of this idea of life, other places maybe looking at Earth with envious eyes.
We're talking about the search for alien life and what it tells us about ourselves. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Jamie, you kind of started to reference this before, but how is life defined? It seems like that would be simple, but you write it's notoriously hard to define.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite unsolved problems in science, because it has proven over the centuries impossible to define life. It's very much you know it when you see it. You know, if you look at a cat versus a mug on your desk, it's very clear to you, but there are lots of gray areas. And even more than that, it is proven really difficult to reduce life down to a set of characteristics. Carl Sagan wrote a really great essay about this in, I think, 1970 for an encyclopedia, showing how every possible requirement for life, you know, that it feeds on energy from its environment, that it reproduces, that it moves, there are always exceptions. There are always examples of life that don't fit the criteria, and non-living things that do. Like a fire, for example, self-sustains by consuming materials from its environment to create energy. And what's really interesting to me is the scientific argument that looking for a definition of life is actually misguided. There are researchers who say that what we actually need to understand life deeply as a fundamental phenomenon is a theory. If you think about it in terms of gravity, a definition of gravity is the force that holds us to the Earth. And like, that's true, but it doesn't help you understand anything scientifically. And one of Newton's great advances was to come up with a fundamental theory of motion, reducing it to just a couple of factors like, mass and velocity, I think. I don't know. I'm not a physicist or a historian of science. But and so in life, you know, we don't need to know what the word life means, which is what a definition would give us. We need to fundamentally understand what it is, what changes when you cross the threshold from chemistry to biology. And we do not have that. Part of the problem is that we only have one example of life. We have life on Earth, which shares one origin, one common ancestor billions and billions of years ago. And so it's really hard to know what about life on Earth is fundamental to life as a phenomenon and what is just how did it happen to happen here.
Dean, how rare is it in the universe to have the conditions that we have on Earth that support life? I mean, we're in this kind of Goldilocks zone, right?
Yeah. And this is one of those great unknowns, is that how rare are we? And, you know, all the evidence right now, based on all of our surveys, is we are one of one. There is no other place out there that is like the Earth. And but that's also mean because we haven't been looking very long, or at least in the right way. And one of the real amazing new fields of astronomy that I'm like nuts over is exoplanets. This is finding planets around other stars. And the idea is that, well, all right, life is on a planet. That might be stretching a little bit, but let's go with that. And so we have our example of life's on a planet. So if we find more planets, that means there's more chances of life. And when these exoplanet surveys began, I remember when these started, and I was a little skeptical of the search, and I know a lot of other astronomers were as well. And I think even the most optimistic astronomers would have said, okay, well, maybe we'll find a planet around every 1,000 stars or a planet around every 100 stars. I don't think there would be anybody who would have said what we are now finding is that there's at least one planet around every 5 stars. And that means in a galaxy like the Milky Way with 300 billion stars, that's 60 billion planets. So statistically, now we're looking at, okay, there's lots of possibilities for where these life forms could exist. They have planets that they could be on. Now we have to look for the right kind of planets. And we are still very, very early on in that search. And so I always like to see those stories on social media of like astronomers find Earth 2.0. And I'm like, no, don't say that one. No, we're not ready for that. We just saw the planet. We saw it. It's Earth size. That's about all we know. Yeah. Don't go there yet. But we're not that far from it. I don't know how many years, but I don't think it's that far away that we're going to be able to detect more signatures of what life might be coming from other planets.
Well, and isn't there this idea, Jamie, that there's been time billions of years ago when life might have existed elsewhere, and a time billions of years from now when the conditions could be right for life someplace else, that maybe our timing's off a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big consideration. And, you know, our solar system is not the first generation of planets, I think. Dean, please tell me if I'm wrong.
Sounds right. Correct.
So, okay, cool. Thank you. So there are solar systems or planetary systems that are much older than ours and did have a head start. But then that raises the question of, if we are looking for intelligent life, for technological life, both because that's, I think, what would be most exciting to find, but also that's what we could find, you know, a species making signals or technology that's detectable. You know, if there are intelligent dolphins somewhere, that's amazing, but we're not going to be able to talk to them. The question then is, how long do these civilizations last, which is a question we're facing with our own very young civilization. We're discovering a lot of ways to end our civilization if we're not careful.
We'll continue our conversation after a short break, and later in the program, we'll discuss the benefits of reading aloud. It's not just for kids. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about the search for extraterrestrial life and what it's taught us about ourselves. My guests are author of the book, The Possibility of Life, Jamie Green, and astronomer and host of the Looking Up podcast, Dean Regas. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Jamie, there was research by an astronomer that was published in 2021, and it asks which stars have or will have, in the next 5,000 years, the right view to detect Earth. And it's an interesting idea because it kind of flips the question of life on its head, asking if there could be other beings out there looking for us. What do you think we can learn by asking this question?
I mean, on the one hand, it's almost practical because it tells us, you know, this ongoing mission of SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is mainly conducted by searching for radio signals coming from other planets. If you've seen the movie Contact, it's like the opening scene there. Well, I guess the opening scene is a zoom through the universe. But anyway, it's the kind of science that she does. And so thinking about how well will this work, because there's, you know, when we are conducting SETI searches, there's scanning the whole sky, but then there's also looking at stars with promising planets. And so the research was asking, like, how many other planets would be able to see us? Because exoplanet detection, you don't just like point a telescope in the sky and take a picture. It's requires certain angles because you're doing it, you're inferring from how the star moves based on the planet's gravity. And so we're only, and this was part of what Dean was getting at, that when we're looking for other Earth-like planets, our search is really constrained by the technology also. And so this research was looking at, you know, how well does this work? We know we're here. Who else might know that we're here? But the other thing is, it feels to me like an extension of that big revolution in understanding of the cosmos that happened in the Renaissance with Copernicus and Galileo, where in that moment in history, we were able to understand that we were a planet just like the other planets in the solar system. This research situates Earth as just another exoplanet, just another planet in the galaxy, which I think emotionally gets at a lot of what people are looking for in the search for alien life, the sense of kinship, of being part of the cosmos. And it's a challenge to us also to not see ourselves as special, to not see ourselves as central, but as just another planet like any other.
Dean, there's a lot we don't know about life on this planet. I wonder, could learning more about organisms that live in extremes here help us better identify life beyond Earth?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the study of, they call them extremophiles. These are these organisms on Earth that live in the craziest places, like in volcanoes or deep parts of the ocean or buried in ice. These are the kind of things that could help us find life in these other very extreme environments, what we consider extreme environments on other planets. Because you look at some place like Mars, for example, and, you know, Mars has, 1% the atmosphere the Earth has. So nothing significant there. The temperature fluctuations, water can't exist on the surface. So then you have to look, all right, what other conditions, what other places on the planet could something form? And so that's the idea as well. There could be life underneath the ground on Mars in caverns. There's water underneath the surface. But then you also want to look for places that don't need water or don't need air. So that in one way opens up these great possibilities that anywhere out there could be a place for life. But boy, statistically saying, we might be that. So that's the big question that I always have. And we don't know is, you know, how rare are we? Are we one in a million, one in a trillion, one in a quintillion? And any kind of, equations, there's that famous Drake equation that kind of says, all right, if we put all these stipulations, then we can see how many civilizations we have. It's a great thought experiment, but it's one of those things where you have an equation, but you don't know any of the values of any of the things, and so you can't say what the answer is.
Jamie, there's this sad irony of our search for other intelligent life, because we once had it here on Earth. The extinct Neanderthal is an example. Do you think, Jamie, we're destined to be lonely because we kind of outcompeted everybody who might have kept us company on this planet?
Sort of. I think we're also destined to be lonely because we see ourselves as separate from the other animals on Earth. I've always been fascinated by Neanderthals. I read The Clan of the Cave Bear when I was like 12. And ever since then, I've just been in love with those ideas. Just thinking about what it was like for there to be an alien kind of people on Earth. And we know now from genetics that humans and Neanderthals mated. You know, most Europeans have about 2% Neanderthal DNA, and the archaeological record suggests that they may have traded as well. And I have this sort of weird nostalgia for that time, even like just that part of it. It was a very, very hard time to be alive. And we don't know if overall those relationships were friendly or not. But even today, there is so much intelligence on Earth. And this was one of the things that writing my book made me think about much more. And I hope that I bring this to readers also, that like we have no idea what might be out there in the cosmos. And there's a lot of hope and yearning for that sort of connection. But I think there's a lot of possibility for that connection here on Earth with really alien kinds of intelligence like dolphins. And I think that there's so much connection and mystery that we can find here on Earth, just like Dean was saying, sort of scientifically, about all the weird kinds of life we don't know about. There is so much on Earth, too, that we don't understand.
Yeah. That Neanderthal DNA, my husband has like 4%. He can't stop talking about it.
I was hearing Jamie wants to start a Neanderthal dating service. I think that's, meet your Neanderthals.
Yeah, my husband's taken. He can't sign up. Jamie, searching for life isn't just imagining who we'd find, but how we'd find us. Tell us about Dyson's fears and the problem of how you search for alien life if maybe they're not exactly broadcasting that they're out there.
Yeah, so this is one of the newer sort of ways of doing a SETI search, which is not just searching for signals that are sort of actively being sent, intentional for us or not, but looking for artifacts. And so the idea of Dyson spheres, they're named for the physicist Freeman Dyson, who wrote a short paper about them, I think in the 60s, just saying like, oh, this could be a thing to look for. I'll explain what they are in a second. But what I love is that he got the idea from a science fiction novel from a few decades earlier called Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon. And so the idea of a Dyson sphere is that as a civilization grows and advances its technology, it may need more and more power. And a great power source is a star. And, you know, we have solar panels on Earth, but they only catch the little bit of solar energy that comes to us. If you needed way more energy, you could build a sphere or like a net of solar panels, essentially, around a star to capture it, all of its energy, and use it. This shows up, you know, the idea started in a sci-fi novel. There's an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation with a Dyson sphere. It's, for anyone who knows, it's the episode where they find Scotty, like, miraculously still alive somehow.
Love that one. Love it.
It's so good. It's so good. And so a few years ago, a SETI scientist thought, well, let me look for Dyson spheres. And this is one of the only kinds of SETI searches that you can do outside of our galaxy. Because what he was looking for and what he was thinking was, okay, if there's a civilization that is advanced enough to build a Dyson sphere, maybe they've become advanced enough to build a lot of them. And that would change the light of a galaxy. If you put a network of satellites to capture the solar energy around a star, you're blocking that light, but then heat and infrared will be emitted from that, sort of the waste from the, the solar capture process. Again, Dean, please save me if I'm going astray. And they didn't find anything. You would know if they had found anything. But I thought that was such an ingenious way of looking for, not just looking for alien life that might be trying to be found, and not just looking for alien civilizations that are still going today, but you could find their relics. They wouldn't still need to be there. And you don't need to make any assumptions about them except that they used technology and needed more energy to do that.
Jamie, what do you think this search for alien life that's been going on for so long, how does it help us understand ourselves?
Well, scientifically, there's a lot of understanding that we need to do about life, about evolution, about geology and planets that is required to do that search elsewhere. So, you know, we have one example. And so we learn more and more about extremophiles, about ecosystems, about technology, and use that to do that search. But I think it also tells us a lot about what we want and what gives us meaning, and our fears and hopes, especially in science fiction. You know, stories about advanced alien civilizations are really projections and reflections of ourselves or testing out possible futures. You know, we were talking about War of the Worlds and Martians coming to Earth for water. Even in War of the Worlds, that is like explicitly a reflection of Western colonialism and war and conquest. So many stories of alien conquest are like white Western writers saying, ooh, we've done some bad stuff. What would it feel like if someone came and conquered us? And then, you know, science fiction conquest stories coming out of Africa, for example, have a really interesting post-colonial way of writing about this all too. And so I think it's just ways of using fiction to see what the possibilities feel like and inhabit them. And what are the different ways that you can be a person? How weird can an alien be and still be someone that we can communicate with? In the end, ideally, ultimately, that can really expand our sense of empathy for different people on Earth. You know, if I can care about an alien, then I can really care about a human being, even if they're very different from me.
Jamie, you ask in your book what it would be like to live with a confident knowledge that aliens exist. You compare it to faith and religion. It's just an exhilarating thought. So I want to ask you both, do you believe, Jamie?
The weird thing about writing my book is I sort of stopped caring because, like I said, I found so much more wonder about life on Earth and the luck that we are here on this like densely inhabited planet. I honestly don't think we're ever going to know for sure. The science is just really tricky that way. But I found a lot of peace through writing the book, like accepting that not knowing.
What about you, Dean? Do you believe?
So, yeah, I go back and forth. It's like every couple months I switch. so I'm in a doubtful stage right now in my life, which I don't know. Maybe I need to introspect and look at that, too. But the idea of this is, you know, it's this battling competition. It's like statistically you got to think there's something else out there. But I can't hang any scientific thing on it whatsoever to say, yes, absolutely there is. So I just I think it's a fun search. I think it is the search of our century. My unscientific opinion is we will find life by the end of the century. And I always say that because I'm not going to live to see that, but I like to predict it. And then it always goes back to that old joke to me is that if we're the only ones out there, man, what a waste of space.
Well, I've been talking with the author of the book, The Possibility of Life, Jamie Green, an astronomer and host of the Looking Up podcast, Dean Regas. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, reading aloud isn't just for children. We'll talk about its benefits for adults. This is Cincinnati Edition.